I wanted to start with a bit from chapter 10, which we didn't get to last time. We had technical difficulties last time, if you recall. And it has to do with this line from Daniel 10, verse 13. This is where Gabriel, or is this Michael at this point? Oh, at this point, yeah, actually at this point, this may very well be, this seems like an angel, but if you recall, this is the thing I was talking about before, where this may actually be kind of our Lord present before Daniel. And just to back up a bit, this is what he tells him. Behold, the hand touched me, set me trembling on my hands and knees, and he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, give heed to the words I speak to you. Stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. For while he was speaking this word to me, I stood up trembling. And he said, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your mind to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So I left him there with the prince of the kingdom of Persia, and came to make you understand what is to befall your people in the latter days. For the vision is for the days yet to come. Okay? There were some patristic commentary that when they would look at that line, they would, you know, what does that mean? You evidently have divine beings and angels. Is the prince of Persia, is, not unlike the question at the beginning of The Wizard of Oz, you know, are you a good witch or a bad witch? You know, if you're some kind of angelic being, Are you a good angel? Are you a bad angel? And there's some patristic commentary that you can find where they will, I think it's Jerome, he will understand this as like a conflict of good and bad angels. So in other words, this really demonic being doesn't want the Jews to return to the temple, to return to their own land. And so that's why, now that the Persians are in charge, he's sort of influencing the Persians, keep the Jewish people here. Okay? But by the time of Gregory, this is Pope Gregory, he's understanding this to mean that actually these are all angels. These are all good beings. Now, that then raises the question, well, why would good angels be opposing each other? You know, well, how would you explain that? When we do the little unit on, by the way, you'll appreciate this. When we do the unit on what I call Angelology 101 before we start reading the Screwtape letters, those are the sophomores. We talk about how it is that angels and devils would be at war. And, of course, there are all these imaginative depictions of it. But the students want to know, well, look, if you're a being with a mind and will, and you don't have a body, and you don't have, like, weapons, and, I mean, how do you wage war? You know, what does that even look like? And so this is what I tell them. Aren't there times that, and I kind of look at the daughters when I say this, aren't there times when you have a kind of conflict or war with your mom? Now, how does that war proceed? Are you, like, rolling around on the floor, pulling hair, and scratching and screaming? No, your mom is telling you, young lady, you are going to do this. And you are on the inside thinking, no, I'm not. And what you have is a battle of wills. What you have is a battle of wills. Who's going to outlast who? Okay? There may be nothing physical, in fact, that's happening at all. I mean, there may be facial expressions and whatnot, but there isn't. It's not like you've got the Nerf bat and you're going to go into the basement. Whoever comes out, you know, standing, whoever's left standing, that's who gets their way. No, it's a battle of wills. And if you, when you are a spirit, when all you have is mind and will, that's what your battles look like. They're battles of will. And so that's what it sounds like, you know, initially with these, the angel of the prince of Persia withstood me. It's just like a battle of wills, right? They're sort of staring each other down. Who's going to be first? But if these really are good angels, then why would they be having battles of wills? And St. Thomas raises this question, and he says the following. Jerome, he talks about how it is that these were devils. But according to Gregory, the prince of the kingdom of Persia was a good angel appointed to the guardianship of that kingdom. To see, therefore, how one angel can be said to resist another, we must note that divine judgments in regard to various kingdoms, various men, are executed by the angels. Okay? So that's the first thing you have to understand, is that when God governs his universe, and when he governs people, he isn't doing it himself directly. I mean, what's the point of having all these spiritual beings if you aren't going to use them? There also is a kind of a fittingness of dignity. Does the CEO go around the office like delivering the mail and emptying the garbage? Doesn't he hire people for that? Likewise, there are all sorts of things that they really don't need to be done by God directly. That you have a guardian angel. Right? St. Thomas will say, drawing on the tradition from the fathers, that every good suggestion that you have, every good idea that comes to you, comes through the mediacy of your guardian angel. Right? That your guardian angel suggests things to you all the time. And maybe you listen, and maybe I'm busy, right? Maybe you don't. But that suggestion is coming through the angel. And again, it's not that God doesn't deign to, you know, visit you or make his presence to you. But again, if you've got all these spiritual beings, why not use them? And in general, think about the way, in fact, that just people around you, it may be, yes, God moving your heart in some way, but it's happened through someone saying something to you. You know, through someone saying, could be a friend, could be one of your family, could be something you just heard on the radio. There are all sorts of ways that God is going to use his creation to get to you. He doesn't have to, like, you wake up in the morning and there's an apparition in the mirror. Ooh, right? You can, no, there are perfectly ordinary, that would be cool, scary, but there are perfectly ordinary human beings who can give you the message. And, right, if there's an angel deputed to you, then that angel can give you those interior suggestions or those interior ideas. Okay, so first you have to understand that St. Thomas is talking from the point of view that the world is being run by these angels. Okay, it happens that at various kingdoms and various men, there are contrary merits or demerits, so that one of them is subject to or placed over one another. As to what is the ordering of divine wisdom on such matters, the angels cannot know unless God reveals it to them. So they need to consult divine wisdom. Wherefore, insomuch as they consult the divine will concerning various contrary and opposing merits, they are said to resist one another. Not that their wills are in opposition, since they are all of one mind to the fulfillment of the divine decree, but that the things about which they seek knowledge are in opposition. So in other words, if you are the guardian angel of Persia, you can look at the presence of Daniel and these Hebrew people and say, these people, they're a good influence here. They're converting these kings. And no doubt that's redounding at some level out there. Remember that when this vision appears to Balthazar, the writing on the wall, immediately one of his wives says, get Daniel, right? He's got a reputation. People know that this is a man who's somehow connected to God. Okay, so if you're the guardian angel of Persia, you may look at that and say, we need the Hebrews here. They're having a good leavening effect. But obviously, if you're Michael, you're the guardian angel of the Hebrew people, you're going to say, it's time for them to go back. It's time for them to go back, build their old temple, and be restored in the true worship of God. And now you might not have a meeting of minds about that right away. Okay? So the angel of Persia withstands me. No, he wants the Hebrew people and Daniel around longer to have a better effect. And what do they have to do? They have to refer to management. Right? They have to kick it upstairs. And management says, no, they have to be let go. They have to be released. So that's how you could have this disagreement with the prince of Persia, with the prince of the Greeks, that these various peoples have their own angels. And, of course, your job is to, you know, do the best you can in terms of the spiritual work or the spiritual good of that group of people. So that would mean, you know, the United States has its kind of its own guardian angel, you know, presumably working overtime, long hours. So I have to assume there are a lot of guardian, national guardian angels out there that really have their work cut out for them. Okay. Were there any questions about what we talked about last time? That was just the last part that I didn't get to because of the technical difficulties I had. I wanted to start, if I could, with Antiochus. If you have your Bible, you know, if you have a Bible handy, turn it to 2 Maccabees. It's chapters 6 and 7. And maybe it'd also be helpful to remind ourselves of the map here. The map is on the map is on 39, and there's also another one on 40. All through this section, chapters 11 and 12 of Daniel, there are these extensive prophecies about the king of the north and the king of the south. And of course, what this is referring to is this period after Alexander's empire. Alexander, in the brief time he was around, he was able to kind of hold the thing together. But everybody understood that once he died, the thing was going to break up. Alexander had two sons of his own, one through Roxana, and the other through Roxana. I think they actually had some kind of marriage. The other was through a mistress. Both of them were murdered. Because they stood as obstacles to power. And basically what happened was that the empire was divided up among the generals. So Seleucus is the one who took what would be modern-day Turkey, Iraq, Iran, that area. And it's called the Seleucid Empire after this guy, Seleucus. Ptolemy is the one who took the Egyptian part. And there are two others, but Seleucus and Ptolemy, those are this are central. Ptolemy is the Ptolemaic line. The person that you would know from that would be Cleopatra. Cleopatra is actually the woman we call Cleopatra is Cleopatra the Seventh. There were several Cleopatras. She's Cleopatra the Seventh, but for us, she's the Cleopatra. She is the last of the Ptolemies, and in other words, she's the last of this family of Greek rulers who ruled Egypt. When I was at Xavier is a black Catholic university, and there was this kind of celebration of Egypt as being like part of black heritage. I've already thoroughly thrashed on that in terms of how it is that the people in Egypt, they're Arabs, they're Hamites or Semites, they're not related to the Negro population that was brought over here as slaves at all. They're not related at all. But now now an additional thing. There would be girls who would wear these T-shirts of like Cleopatra or these queens from Egypt. And, you know, they'd want to kind of like tap into that. Cleopatra was Greek. In fact, she was one of the first of the Ptolemies that we know of to learn Egyptian. Because at court, and in terms of the educated class in Egypt, they all spoke and wrote Greek. They didn't deign to learn the language of the people that they conquered. And in fact, they didn't intermarry. Cleopatra's father, if I'm remembering this rightly, I think was also, let's see, how did this go again? It was like incestuous intermarriage. Her father was her uncle, but her grandfather. Her grandfather was also her uncle because her grandfather had married his daughter. Yeah. So they, yeah, they kept, they would not branch out. They the Ptolemies tended to marry within the family, and they didn't want to marry the rabble, even to that extent. By the way, though, in ancient Egypt, they did that as well. In the Pharaoh's family, they tended to marry. It was not uncommon to have brothers and sisters marry in the pharaonic line. So that had been going on in Egypt for a very long time. So what you're reading is essentially this warfare between these descendants of these original generals. The king of the south, those are the Ptolemies, those are the the line from that general, and then the king of the north, Seleucus, that is the king from that line. And Antiochus is this king of the north. I wanted to look at Maccabees 6 and 7 because this talks about the persecution that essentially is being foretold in Daniel. I have to find a way to get it in a format that's easy to convey to you, but if you're, because I have it in a Google book, one of the Anglican commentaries takes chapter 11 and it relates it sort of event by event to this warfare between these two kings. So remember, there are these pretty minute descriptions of the king of the south will pull back and the king of the south will do this and the king of the north will do that. And you can historically relate these prophecies to specific things that happened in this conflict. That's why it is that if you want to deny the supernatural character of this book of Daniel, you've got to say that it's written in the second century. That as you're writing about events that are unfolding, and then you project it back to Daniel. Because you've got to explain something. If this is written at the time of Daniel, Daniel appears to have a fairly clear vision of what's happening in this conflict between the king of the north and king of the south. But again, it doesn't do it in our thing, but in this Anglican commentary, it relates it to specific movements back and forth. Go ahead.
Jill was our group leader today. She brought in a video where they read straight from 11, and the video, meanwhile, was writing out everything that was actually going on in history.
Oh, very good. Oh, yep. Sorry. Now, where'd you get that from? Here I am reading these old dusty books, and you've got like a cool video.
Bible footnotes had it listed.
Oh, okay.
Specifically, and of course, I don't have Maccabees in that Bible. But so then I just went to YouTube, and there somebody has an excellent video with that.
Well, okay. So let's do this. You send your thing to Joan so that she can send it around, and then I'll find this now totally lame piece of writing that, like, if you're into that sort of thing, you can read that too. Okay, so you can get both. When you say what's ESV?
English
Standard Version.
Yeah, and it just is fantastic. ESV. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a great footnotes, and it had them all listed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, super. And probably what it goes back to is this work that was done in the thing that I have is from the 1850s. So in the 1850s, 1860s, that's where they started doing that.
So
go ahead.
It comments in here, one of the footnotes, that as Daniel wrote these scrolls, they were sealed, like sealed.
Oh, yeah.
They were prophecies.
Do yeah.
Do you know when they would have been opened?
No.
No?
No. Lost in the mists of time. Yeah. But remember, I mean, they would, you know, some of these things, they get unearthed and we hear about them. Like, for example, isn't it in Nehemiah that they've actually physically lost the law? And then somebody's digging up something and finds a copy of the law. And what do? They bring it out and they read it all day long. Right? They're out there if you get like half a chapter of Deuteronomy at Mass, I mean, what are you doing? Like your eyes are crossing and you're falling asleep. Here are these people, right, hearing chapter after chapter, and they're crying. They're listening, they're crying because they're realizing, oh my gosh, here are all these things we're supposed to do that we're not doing. You know? Sometimes I think if we're Catholics and somehow all the law was lost and then I come back, you know, you started ruling, Catholics would sit there, do I have to do that too? Do I have to do that too? Right? It would be that they wouldn't be crying, they'd just be cranky. Couldn't we just bury the thing and pretend we didn't find it? Okay. So, 2 Maccabees, and yes, if you have a Protestant Bible, these are like bootleg books. These are like your you know, forbidden books. I just think that even if you didn't think that these were inspired, I mean, the fact is they're inspiring. And so I'll make my case with specifics here. Let's start in chapter 6. And Eleazar, the martyrdom of Eleazar. Eleazar, one of the scribes in high position, a man now advanced in age. This starts at verse 18. Noble presence was being forced to open his mouth to eat swine flesh. But he, welcoming death with honor rather than life with pollution, went up to the rack of his own accord, spitting out the flesh, as men ought to go who have the courage to refuse things that it's not right to taste, even for the natural love of life. Those who were in charge of that unlawful sacrifice took the man aside because of a long acquaintance with him and privately urged him to bring milk, meat of his own providing, proper for him to use, and pretend he was eating the flesh of the sacrificial meal, which had been commanded by the king, so that by doing so he might be saved from death, be treated kindly on account of his old friendship with them. But making a high resolve, worthy of his years and the dignity of his old age, and the gray hairs which he had reached with distinction, and his excellent life even from childhood, and moreover, according to the holy God-given law, he declared himself quickly and telling them to send him to Hades. Such pretense is not worthy of our time of life, he said, lest many of the young should suppose that Eleazar, in his 90th year, has gone over to an alien religion. And through my pretense, for the sake of living a brief moment longer, that they should be led astray because of me, while I defile and disgrace my own age. Okay? So, this chapter begins with essentially what's described by this term, the abomination of desolation. That the this is the phrase that's used in Daniel, that's used in Daniel 12, and I think in Daniel 10. And of course, it's the phrase that's referred to later by our Lord in Matthew 24. That when you see the abomination of desolation set in the temple, then you will know, right, the time has come. And what happened, you'll see earlier in the chapter, that they basically set up this pagan god in the in the midst of the temple. That they tore open the Holy of Holies, and they put in this, it's Dionysius. So not just a nice tame god like Athena, right? The god of Bacchic, the god of passion and wine and excess, right? That's what they set up in the Holy of Holies. Okay? So, and the test of you giving up your faith to this pagan invader, that you'll eat swine flesh, that you'll eat pig. Okay, and here's Eleazar undergoing torments, and his friends are saying, "Come on, why don't you just eat some phony stuff? I've got some cow here. Just say that it's pig, and they'll let you go." And he's just indignant at the suggestion. You know, this will give scandal. Now, by the way, this gives me the opportunity. You know, scandal, that word is so abused. Scandal, the way we use the word, means something shocking, right? She wore a scandalous red dress, right? The idea is that it's somehow shocking. That's not what scandal is. Scandal, remember, to create a stumbling block. It's that you give bad example that becomes persuasive. So the worst forms of scandal aren't shocking at all. The worst forms of scandal aren't shocking. They simply influence people in ways that, oh well, I guess that's how we're supposed to act. And so that's what Eleazar is. I would rather die than give scandal. then give a bad example that would then influence other people. Okay? Chapter 7, by the way, one of my favorite chapters in the whole of the Maccabees. This is the woman who has seven sons, and all seven of them are martyred, one by one in front of her. And let's start at verse 6. They're basically cutting off their hands and their feet. They're frying them in skillets. I mean, they are using like the worst forms of torture that they know of. And here's the mom. The Lord God is watching over us, and in truth has compassion on us, as Moses declared in his song, which bore witness against the people to their faces when he said, and he will have compassion on his servants. Okay? So she's continuing to exhort these boys, even though they're being martyred one by one. Now, you would completely understand, as a mom, you're watching your children being killed, that you would just be overwhelmed with grief, that you would just want it to stop. And instead, what this woman is doing is saying, don't give in to this guy. Right? And in fact, the one that has always stuck with me from this chapter, let's see, it's almost, I think it's the verse 20. The mother was especially admirable and worthy of honorable memory. Though she saw her seven sons perish within a single day, she bore it with good courage. She encouraged each one of them in the language of their fathers. Filled with a noble spirit, she fired her woman's reasoning with a man's courage and said to them, I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life and breath, nor I who set the order of the elements in you. Therefore, the Creator of the world, who shaped the beginning of man and devised the origin of all things, will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again, since now you have forgot yourselves for the sake of the law. Okay? In other words, you could ask, what allows this woman to do this? Because this just seems totally contrary to the kind of strength you would have as a mother, right? She has the firm conviction of the resurrection. I am not losing you. I will get you back. But I will get you back because you're doing and believing the right thing. And somehow, if you weren't doing that, then I wouldn't get you back. Right? That is perhaps an amazing conviction in the resurrection. And then there's the last brother, the youngest one. And Antiochus himself is on the scene, trying to get him to apostatize, promising riches and wealth and status and all that. Verse 25, since the young man would not listen to him at all, the king called the mother to him and urged him to advise the youth to save himself. After much urging on his part, she undertook to persuade her son. But leaning close to him, she spoke in her native tongue as follows, deriding the cruel tyrant. My son, have pity on me. I carried you 9 months in my womb, nursed you for 3 years, have reared you and brought you up to this point in your life, and have taken care of you. I beg you, my child, to look at the heaven and the earth and see everything that is in them, and recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed. Thus also mankind comes into being. Do not fear this butcher, but prove worthy of your brothers. Accept death, so that in God's mercy I may get you back again with your brothers. While she was still speaking, the young man said, what are you waiting for? I will not obey the king's command, but I obey the command of the law that was given to our fathers through Moses. So, how do you like that? Even with martyrs, the boy is still not listening to you, or the boy is still like, oh, quit making me wear my hat, quit buttoning my coat, right? Quit mothering me, right? So, here she is exhorting him not to give in to the tyrant. And once he said, stop exhorting me. You think I'm going to give in to this guy? Okay? But again, imagine that inner strength that she has to be able to tell him, look at the world around you, that this is the world that God has made, and I didn't make you. I brought you into the world. I brought you in, I nursed you. But ultimately, you are God's creation. And, of course, the great temptation with our children is to think of them exactly that way. They're our children. they belong to us. But clearly the teaching here that this mother is driving home to her children, you're not mine. You're God's. You're God's children. I have care of you. Yes, I bring you into the world. I care for you. I'm to bring you. But my job as a parent is to bring you back to God. So you're not mine. You're God's. Right? And that is a very, I think, hard thing to hear, and it's a very hard thing to internalize. We want our children to be our own. But they're not. They don't belong to us. They came through us. You know, we gave them, as it were, their life. But who they are as human beings, and especially what they're called to do and bound to do, that is something that comes from God. It doesn't come from us. So that gives you a picture of what is being prophesied, why it is that Daniel would have such a... why he would be so frightened, why he would think that what he's seeing is so dark. That yes, the chosen people will go back, but eventually they will go back to a period of intense persecution. And the thing that, remember, the thing that's different about this, they waged war against the Canaanites. But the Canaanites were not, as it were, persecuting them for their religion. The Canaanites would influence them in bad ways. But the Canaanites didn't have the idea, they've got their religion, we've got our religion's right, theirs is wrong, and we've got to try to bring them over to Baal or Ashtoreth. You know, that happened because the Israelites were open to bad influence. This is an actual religious persecution where the goal that the persecutor has is to pull you away from the faith. So that's new. That's new. Remember, the Egyptians, none of these other people have the goal of pulling the Israelites away from God or away from the faith. That may happen through the Israelites' bad behavior. But that's not the, you know, Balthazar, Darius, Nebuchadnezzar, any of these people, their goal is not to take the Israelites away from the worship of God. That is Antiochus's goal. That's why he's forcing them to eat swine flesh. Okay? I want you to violate your laws and then be complicit in violating your laws, because I'm pulling you away from this thing that you're worshiping. I'm moving on to this point here, Daniel's prophecies and the Antichrist. If you there's a short thing that Cardinal Newman did when he was still an Anglican minister, called the Patristical Idea of the Antichrist. And what he does is, working with sources that are mostly 2nd and 3rd century, what is the picture that people had in the early church of the Antichrist, of what he would be like? And of course, when you read that, Daniel is, of the books from the Old Testament, Daniel is the one that comes up again and again. And there are three things in particular that he gets from Daniel. So in chapter 11, 25 to 28, you have this picture that you're given in a way of what the Antichrist is like. Hold on. Let's see. So, again, talked about in terms of the king of the north. He shall stir up power, his courage against the king of the south with a great army. The king of the south shall wage war with an exceedingly great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. Plots shall be devised against him. Even those who eat his rich food shall be his undoing. His army shall be swept away. Many shall be fall down slain. As for the two kings, their minds shall be bent on mischief. They shall speak lies at the same table. He shall return to his land with great substance. His heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will work his will. Right? You're being told about somebody in particular. Right? These are all prophecies, right, of Antiochus. And so it is from that, then, the early church, they had a very clear idea that when the term Antichrist is used by John, in the Apocalypse, and when he uses that in his letters, he's thinking of somebody in particular. He's not just thinking of, like, a group of people or an ethical system or a political system or a political point of view. In other words, Antichrist is not a symbol or idea, that it's a person. And again, this is drawn chiefly from the prophecies concerning Antiochus, who again is a particular person, that the Antichrist would be like that. It would be a particular person. Okay? And Newman has a section on the religion of the Antichrist. In other words, what does this guy believe? What is he trying to inculcate in others? And if you look at verse 37, he shall give no heed to the God of his fathers, or to the one beloved by women. He shall not give heed to any other god, for he shall magnify himself above all. He shall honor the god of fortresses instead of these, a god whom his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. Okay? And you notice you when you see that expression, you know, we shall worship the god of fortresses. In other words, this is a guy who cares about power, who cares about force. So you remember when Pius XI was the one who wrote an encyclical against communism, against atheistic communism. And Stalin was informed of this and said, you know, the Pope is writing something against you. And Stalin's response was, how many divisions does the Pope have? You know, he was completely unimpressed. For Stalin, it was all about might. It was all about power. How many divisions does he have? By the way, by the papacy of Pope John Paul II, they didn't have the same point of view anymore. When they found out that the cardinals had elected a Polish pope, that was red alert. That was completely red alert. That from their from the Soviet high command point of view was a disaster, and that's why they contracted an assassin to take out Pope John Paul II. That you did not want, especially this guy. Because they already had a dossier on him when he'd been Archbishop of Krakow. This is not somebody that we want on a world stage. And if you recall, if you know the details of that, when Muhammad Ali Asha had the Pope's head in the crosshairs, right? And he said every target he had before then, he always succeeded. Once in the crosshairs, they're done. But at that moment, Pope John Paul II saw a little pin from Our Lady of Fatima on a girl in front of him, and he leaned forward. Boof! So it hit the bullet hit him in the shoulder. It didn't hit him in the head. That's why, after he was out of the hospital, he made a pilgrimage to Fatima to personally give thanks to Our Lady of Fatima. Okay? So the view of the Soviet Union changed by the time they got to Pope John Paul II. They recognized that battalions weren't everything. And as it turned out, the fall of the Soviet Union wasn't because of battalions. You know, it was a combination of arguably things that Ronald Reagan did, but also the continuing pressure that they got from Pope John Paul II, especially in Poland, through the Solidarity Solidarność, the Solidarity Movement. Finally. He will unleash the greatest persecution of the faithful in history. Okay, that's the prophecy of the Antichrist. That, in fact, Daniel is the name Daniel only occurs in the Gospels once. It occurs in Matthew 24, where he's prophesying the coming of the Antichrist. All right, so Matthew 24:15. When you read, as you saw in Daniel, of the abomination of desolation, then you will know, right, the time has come. And Newman, you know, he's writing in the early 1800s, so he talks about, well, we've already, maybe this just sounds fabulous, but, you know, over the top, I guess, but, you know, we've already seen things like this. He says, remember that during the French Revolution, the revolutionaries they desecrated the Cathedral at Notre Dame in Paris, and they brought in a naked actress who was supposed to, it was kind of, you know, she had like laurel leaves on her hair and whatnot, not much else, and she was supposed to be Goddess Reason. So now we were going to worship goddess reason. Okay? So there were things like that that Newman says we've seen already that are kind of a foreshadowing of what it would look like. That you could actually have the church defiled and things put in its place. You know, like reason, which is going to be worshipped. When I look at this section of persecution, you know, our model for persecution tends to be what you see in like in the early church, where, you know, people fed to the lions, people maimed or burned or whatnot, all those kind of things. And if it really is like the worst kind of persecution ever, you know, I think the model would be, if you really want to read a disturbing persecution, Japan. If any of you have read the book, Shoshako Endo's book, Silence, or the movie, or seen the movie, where the Japanese under the shogunate, their idea was really psychological warfare. We don't want to make martyrs. We want to make apostates. So they would kill people, but the idea was that you wanted to use psychological warfare to sort of wear them down. That they'll give it up of themselves. So, for example, when they would go into a village that was a largely Christian village, they would dig a pit and fill it full of garbage and filth and animal excrement and human excrement, and then sort of line up the Christians and tie them up almost like mummies. They leave an arm free, and then you hang them upside down and you dunk them in this pit until they gave in. And you know, some number of people, I mean, the moment you construct this thing, they're out. Other people, you know, they might make the wrapping process and then they bail. Other people, you dunk them for a while and then they give in. And the sign that you gave in was they would put this image of Our Lord and Our Lady and you had to trample on it. You had to stamp on it. It was what was called the fumie. It was the image of Our Lord and Our Lady. So, when you read about that persecution, it's awful, because you're dealing with an enemy that isn't just, how to put it, they just want to hurt you really bad. It's like they want to demoralize and despiritualize you, you know, crush you from the inside. Like if you remember back, maybe for some of you this is remembering all the way back to high school reading 1984. You remember the last image of 1984 is Winston Smith has been so crushed from the inside that he looks at this picture of his of Big Brother, and he loves Big Brother. Right? That's the idea. And this persecution, the way that our Lord describes it, it will be so terrible that even the elect, you know, even those who you think are going to make it or actually do make it seem as though they're not going to make it. And in fact, it will be shortened, you know, for that reason. It'll be shortened for that reason. Now, I realize that's the kind of thing we don't like hearing. You know, that's very worrisome to hear. It can get us very, very anxious. But I think the useful thing that you can get out of this, When I was growing up, my father had lived through a Great Depression, and he had lived through people knocking on the back door for egg sandwiches and things like that. And so he always had the fear, you know, 70s, 80s, I remember this as a child, that the economy would collapse again. And he would tell me that. And he would tell me that not because he wanted me to just worry. He would tell me that because he wanted me to be ready. Don't think that the things that we have and the things around you are just always going to be there. You have to be ready on the inside if things get really tough and things get really hard. You can't just be surprised. And I think there are a lot of people that, with regard to the persecution of the faithful, they don't ever want to talk about that. They don't ever want to look about that. It's just too disturbing to them. Then what happens when it comes? Then you are totally unprepared. And it's something that, without scaring yourself or without panicking yourself, you have to be open to this coming. I mean, already Christianity is the most persecuted religion in the world. That is a matter of statistical fact. Every year, according to secular sources, not church sources, not religious sources, there are between 100 and 150,000 people who die for the Christian faith every year. Okay? Worldwide. Now, the reason that that may be news to some of you is because it's not on Fox News or CNN or CNBC. The mainstream media is never going to report Christian persecution. Never. And it's not because of some great conspiracy. It's just they're not interested in that stuff. They're not religious people. They don't care about religion. So it's not interesting to them. But, you know, if you want a book-length treatment, John Allen, who writes for National Catholic Reporter, he's actually kind of a left of center in his perspective, and yet he's right. The book is called The Global War on Christians. And hey, if you're more into like these forms of media, like Jill was talking about, he gives an hour-long talk on YouTube. So if you like can't make it through the book, John Allen, Global War on Christians, right? And there's about an hour-long talk that he gave several years ago when the book came out. Okay, so in other words, for many people out there, you know, this persecution, it's not the persecution of the Antichrist, but is there persecution happening out there, such that Christians can take consolation in the words of Matthew, in the words of Daniel, you know, that this informs their life on the ground? Yes. There are many, many Christians out there for whom these teachings are things that inform their life as it's lived. They're not looking forward to some kind of bad thing that's coming. They're in it now. They're in it now. So we need to realize this is the way this book is written. It's not just a future event, although that future event is important, but also all the various persecutions that in some way lead up to that future event. So next time we'll look at Daniel 13, the history of Susanna. If you just have that Protestant Bible, your book of Daniel's out now. So you're gonna have to borrow some chapters from friends or go online. Or very good. See you next week.